Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang, where we will be continuing with the 73rd episode of Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. The last fortnight, we went into the Sanatana Sarathi. Now we are back with this book. As always, we find amazing descriptions, we find some lovely insights and some inspiring anecdotes, and that is what will happen today as well. This Thursday is one of those special Thursdays for Prem and I, because we'll be having two satsangs today. One is right now, the afternoon satsang, and we'll also have an evening satsang, which you can catch live on the Asia stream, as well as our YouTube channel, because that will be a video satsang. I would prefer that you tune into YouTube and get the video satsang live, because there are some really delectable videos that we will be showing you as part of the satsang. And since this is the month of November, getting into the birthday season, no prizes for guessing that the evening video satsang will be something related to our beloved Swami's birthday. On that note, let's get back to the topic on hand, which is Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba, as documented by Dr. John Hislop. And joining me is Brother Prem. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind, and Sairam to all our listeners. Indeed, this satsang, as I was going through the text that we're going to be discussing today, so many beautiful insights for life, for functioning within the Sai organization, how we need to approach some of the day-to-day issues that we often face, and that makes this entire conversation so useful, as we've been seeing through the all the discussions that we've had. So in that sense, it's going to be really interesting what we're going to go through today too. But the whole episode starts with a very interesting thing that happens, which Hislop notes. I think it happens when Swami is visiting the town of Anantapur. By then, the college is established, clearly, because I think we're already in the 80s from some of the references that we've had before. Maybe early 80s or late 70s. So clearly, the Anantapur hostel is established. Swami has made many trips there. We've heard, we've seen references to that even earlier. But in this particular road trip, this is what he writes. He says, "On the road to Anantapur, we came upon a beggar woman who was blind. Baba gave her money and she responded with, 'Sairam Swami.' It had been 2 years since he had been to Anantapur, but without Baba even speaking, she recognized him." So this is the note with which Dr. Hislop starts this part, and it's so very beautiful. Swami is going to that town after 2 years. So clearly this woman has had interactions with Swami before, probably on that same road. But Swami, she goes up to Swami, Swami gives her money, and instantly she recognizes Swami, and she says, "Sairam Swami."
One thing that is so subtle yet beautiful over here is that we often, when somebody asks us to describe Swami, we describe him in terms of how he appears. That's the first thing to the eyes. Then possibly we describe as to how sweet his voice is, how he sounds. And then if we have got the opportunity to touch his feet or touch his hand, we then describe possibly how he feels. So when somebody asks us who is Swami and to describe Swami, we describe what our senses perceive. But here is this woman who doesn't have eyes. So it's obvious that she doesn't know how Swami looks like. She possibly doesn't know how anybody looks like. And Swami has not spoken anything. And yet she is able to recognize that it is Swami. From this little episode, it becomes very evident that Swami is beyond the senses. Swami is not somebody to be seen or heard or touched. Swami is somebody who has to be experienced, because I think that is what makes her recognize that it is Swami. And that is beautiful and inspiring in the current scenario, because honestly, we cannot see, touch or hear Swami physically. I mean, of course, we have the media where we can see Swami's beautiful form. We have the media where we can hear his golden voice, but in the physical sense, we can't do that. It is not something to feel very sorrowful or despondent about, because Swami is an experience. And that, and he is available for us to experience even to this day.
Just to pull it down from the lofty idea that you gave, when I read this, the idea that I got is probably nobody else would give her that much money, right? She probably recognized Swami through his generosity. You know, we recognize Swami, as you said, by seeing Swami, sometimes with his fragrance. Many times it happens, you know, with Swami's fragrance, we'll know which side Swami is. And sometimes with his touch, with his word, with his sweet voice. But probably this lady recognized Swami through her generosity. And that also is a message, right? Because as you said, we may not be able to see Swami in that form that we so very much love. But every time somebody is being more kind to us, more generous to us, more loving to us, if we can pause and say that this is Swami's love, you know, you recognize Swami's love coming through to you through that person. Can you say that you're distant from Swami? Can you say that Swami is not with you there? And I think this is something that we all have at some point recognized, you know, some unknown person coming and showering some kind of kindness on us, or we getting help from some unknown quarter.
Random stranger.
Don't we stop and think that, Swami, thank you. You know, you've come to me in this form. And maybe that is one more way of looking at this short interaction that he describes.
Absolutely. Usually when beggars come, we try to give them something so that we can get away from them. This might have been a rare case where she's seeing that somebody is actually searching and coming for her. And though she cannot see what is the money Swami is giving, maybe Swami gave her a note. And I don't think in India people often give notes to beggars. They're usually given coins.
Dr. Anil Kumar, Swami's, Professor Anil Kumar, Swami's translator, he was narrating that he's been with Swami on multiple occasions to Kodaikanal. Right? So he said that there are so many times when they're going on the highway and you know, there'll be fields on either side. Swami will stop and call some lady who is like deep into the field. And Swami will wait there in the middle of the road till that person comes running. And like this case, many of them recognize Swami because they've seen Swami year after year, every summer coming there. And Swami would come, Swami would call them, Swami would give them some money. And on one occasion he asked Swami, Swami, why is it that you give so much money? Right? I mean, if you want to give alms, you should give some amount which is like alms. You shouldn't give them so much. And the beautiful and very profound answer Swami gave is, whenever I give something, I give myself. Right. For you it is money, for you it is alms, for you it is food or whatever. He said, whenever I give anything to anybody, I am giving a part of myself to them, and that is grace that cannot be quantified at all. Right? And when you say beggars in front of Swami, are we all not beggars in front of Swami? Has Swami not given us alms? And really, it's such a moving episode of Swami, somebody recognizing Swami so sweetly in this form, right?
And after they have driven off, I think after giving the woman whatever and blessing her, when they've driven off, Hislop says, the woman seems to be happy. And Swami says, she was born blind but is always happy. She has no worries. How could that be, Swami? Look at her life. It must be a life of misery. Swami asks, why? She has no desires and is content. She does not know the life of a person who has eyes. She does not think that others are different from her. Her family is worried about her condition, but she has no worries. Then Hislop again asks, how could she not want a life different from that of a beggar? And Swami replies, desires arise from the tendency of the mind to compare. It is chiefly the eyes, the vision, which presents to the mind opportunities for comparison. She is blind. Her mind is not busy with comparison, so desires do not arise. Such a beautiful conversation where, you know, Swami makes it very clear that to be happy, you need to have contentment. And for contentment, there should be no comparison. Swami says that she doesn't compare at all, and therefore she is content. She doesn't have any sorrow, any worry that she's a beggar. And as for eyes, Swami says she is not even aware of what it means to have an eye. So while her family may be worried, she's absolutely not, because she doesn't know what it is. And she feels this is how everyone also is.
Man, absolutely. And what a beautiful way to drive that important message. We always think, you know, to be happy, you need something, right? And for somebody like Hislop, who comes from one of the most richest countries, to see happiness in a beggar must have been quite unsettling and, you know, confounding, to say the least. Mm. And it's a beautiful explanation. As you said, the more you think about it, you understand how deeply it can reflect in our own lives. You don't have to be in that economical status to understand this. We all think we have lesser than we need, right?
As correct.
Swami would say, who's the richest man in the world? The one who has...
maximum contentment.
Maximum contentment. And who's the poorest? One who has much desires is the poorest man, Swami would say. In that sense, we all are poorer than we are, really, in that sense. So this is beautiful. But what continues after that is even more interesting. When Swami says that she has no desires, she doesn't compare, Hislop asks, if she continues happy and content, will she be finished with life and death and be free at the time she dies? And Swami retorts by saying, no, that requires spirituality. Again, a beautiful addition to what Swami said, because we often think, you know, desirelessness is the ultimate state. Mohakshaya is moksha, Swami would say. But Swami is making it very clear that sometimes it happens even with us. You know, we don't have desires because we have already given up the idea of entertaining some desires because that is not within our scope. I will not have a desire for a Lamborghini because I know that I'm never going to be able to afford that in my lifetime. So, I mean, I've kind of canned that desire away. That doesn't mean I'm desireless.
Absolutely. You know, I can so much relate to this, say, about a decade ago when I used to feel that I just want to travel to different parts in India, because Swami would say, Yanna Bharate Tanna Bharata, meaning what is not there in India is not there anywhere in the world.
Right.
It also holds good. We have our own Switzerland with ice cap, snow cap mountains. We have our own deserts. We have our own forests. We have our own coastal areas. Everything we have in India. But that desire that I don't want to go anywhere but be in India was born out of the inability to travel abroad. And by Bhagwan's grace, whenever the opportunity presented, I have definitely enjoyed traveling abroad, and I will not say no to it. So like you said, many of these desires lie dormant in us. They are not expressed because they have not got an opportunity. If they get an opportunity, they would express. Swami would give the example of dry desert land where it looks like there are no weeds growing. But once the first rains come, these weeds sprout out. Swami would say the mind is like that. Desires are like that. They will sprout out. So to be happy, you need to be content. And for that contentment, you can even put on the temporary attachment, temporary detachments that Swami describes, you know. Swami says there is udara vairagya, a kind of detachment that you get because of excess. You know, you overeat food and you feel, I don't want that food. That's also kind of contentment. There is abhava vairagya, the detachment that you get, like how I explained, you know, I don't want to travel abroad because I can't, I don't have.
Right. The grapes are sour.
The grapes are sour, yeah, who wants to go there? The abhava vairagya. Then Swami says there is the purana vairagya, meaning you listen to a satsang, everything is meaningless, only God matters.
Or you give a satsang.
Or you give a satsang, nice. Yes, and you feel, I don't want anything. So that kind of detachment comes. Then also Swami would say there is smashana vairagya. You know, when you see death, just like birth is a very, very poignant situation, very powerful event,
right.
Death is like that. So when you see death, you just realize that after all the thing in life, this is where you're going to end up in. Again, you get detached. And of course, Swami would say there's prasuti vairagya, wherein a woman conceives and when she delivers, she goes through such pain. Everything else in life seems so painless and meaningless and not worth getting attached to. And Swami says, yet the woman has a second child, has a third child. So all these are temporary vairagyas, temporary detachment. So it's not as if temporary detachment is of no use. In fact, many times this temporary detachment can inspire you to practice it regularly and lead to permanent detachment. And to the extent you are temporarily detached, to that extent, you experience contentment and joy also. So Swami is saying that in her case, to the extent that she is not desireless, she doesn't know what it is. The moment she gets an idea of what it is, maybe she will get the desire. That's why Swami says, with that, she will not get moksha or redemption. She definitely needs spirituality.
Right, and extending that analogy that you said Swami would give of the weeds that sprout every time, you know, there's a rain. There's a dry spell and you find that nothing is there. And suddenly, after one shower of rain, you find all of them sprout. That's why in Vedanta, they give the example of you roasting the seeds. The jnana that you get is like roasting the seeds in such a way that whatever happens after this, it'll not going to sprout again. So that is what spiritual wisdom is supposed to do. Right? Swami would say, there is darkness. The only way to get rid of the darkness is to bring light into that place. Nothing else. You can shout at darkness, you can curse darkness, it is not going to go. You will have to bring, and you can even live in darkness, like in the case of this person whom Swami is telling. You just got used to it. You don't crave for anything beyond what the darkness around you. But that does not mean that you are liberated. Unless and until light comes in, jnana comes in. And that's why Swami says, without spirituality, you will never reach the ultimate.
It's like that other example we speak about. A yogi apparently does nothing. And so does a tamasic and lazy fellow.
Right.
But one is a very active doing nothing, whereas other is pure laziness. So there's a world of difference between them. I'm reminded of an interesting episode. You know, once Professor G. Venkatraman, our former director, Radio Sai, he used to deliver so many talks and have his shows on the radio. During one such show, he was answering some questions that had been posed to him, and one interesting question was there. It was whether an atheist, who is a very good person, does everything right, morally good, such a person, will he get liberation, will he get liberated? And the way Professor G. Venkatraman answered it was by saying that you definitely need faith in God. If you're an atheist and you're good, maybe the punyas or the good deeds, meritorious deeds that you have done will win you a birth as a person who is a devotee. And in that birth, you can achieve God. Interestingly, what happened is, as this show was going on live, Swami in Yajur Mandir was listening to the same. You know, that is another thing. Really, Radio Sai is so blessed because Swami later got Radio Sai set installed inside Yajur Mandir, and Swami was one of our listeners. Such a proud thing for Radio Sai. So Swami was listening to Radio Sai, and this thing happened. There was a student who used to serve Bhagwan who was sitting at Swami's feet and pressing his feet. He asked Swami, "Swami, is that the right answer?" Means what Professor G.V. said. Swami said, "No, that is not right." Then he asked Swami, "Then that means, can an atheist get moksha? Can an atheist get liberation?" Swami answered him by saying, "Anybody who can overcome dehavimana, meaning body attachment, anybody who can overcome ego, body attachment, will get moksha." Because that is how Swami says, right? Moha kshaya is moksha, meaning giving up attachment. What attachment? Dehabhimana. So, this is what happened, and later this brother conveyed the same to Professor G. Venkatraman also. But the point I am making is, to get moksha, it doesn't depend on whether you're doing pujas, whether you're doing bhajan. What is the way to define whether you get moksha is whether you have mohokshaya, whether you have given up dehabhimana. And for that Swami says, daivabhimana, or getting attached to God, helps in weakening the strong grip of dehabhimana, or the attachment to the body. So it's about giving up that, and that is why possibly we're encouraged to develop love for God, because it's an easy method of giving up dehabhimana. You can give up dehabhimana even without getting attached to God. You can go through the fiery furnace of life and get tempered and smashed and hammered and realize that it's not worth. Yes, this is a sweet, easy and lovely, enjoyable path. That's why. But all said and done, you have to give up dehabhimana. And I think that's why Swami says here also that to be free at the time she dies, it requires spirituality, or getting attached to the spirit by giving up attachment to the body.
Nevertheless, I think the association with Swami that she's had in that birth will definitely play a huge role in the journey forward. The conversation continues, but I don't know whether it's the same day or a different day, because the topic is very different. Maybe we'll also take a short break, dear listeners, and we'll continue because the theme changes. So don't go away. On the other side of the song, we will continue the satsang on these conversations.
बाह छुड़ाए जात हो निबल जान के मो हृदय से जब जाओ तो सबल में जानू तो निर्बल के बल दीन के बंधो निर्बल के बल दीन के बंधो वचन सुन के बैना हरि मैं नैनहीन तुम नैना हरि मैं नैनहीन तुम नैना थामुंगरिया जान डगरिया ले चालो मोहे जानो तुम्हारे शरण में तुम्हारी शरण में अब मेरो ठोर ठिकानो गोपाल गोपाल हरि तुम आंधे की लखुटिया हरि तुम ही आंधे की लखुटिया तुम ही जिया को चैना हरि मैं नैनहीन तुम नैना हरि मैं नैनहीन तुम नैना दर्शन ते सुख बिन दर्शन दुख प्रभु मेरो मन वा पावे तुम देखे मेरो सूरज उगे तुम बिछड़े छुप जावे गोपाल गोपाल अपने पतित को उबारो अपने पतित को बैगी उबारो नाम रटो दिन रैना हरि मैं नैनहीन तुम नैना हरि मैं नैनहीन तुम नैना हे गिरिधर गोपाल श्यामा दीन दयाल भक्त वत्सल सम के संबल मुकुले असंभार गोपाल 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 गोपाल.
वेलकम बैक डियर लिसनर्स. The song that you heard just now, it is a song by the great Indian saint Suradas, who was born blind. Thank you, Prem, for so aptly selecting it and playing it after we discussed about that woman who was blind. And again, you know, I'm just taking a little detour to go into that Suradas story. It is so beautiful. It is said that the song, I will not go into the meaning of the first stanza now, but I'll come to it in the end. What happens is Suradas is walking and lost in Krishna, he falls into a well. And then he starts screaming out for help because he needs somebody to assist him. And it is, I don't know if it's a well or a pit, whatever, he falls in the ground. And there is this little boy who comes and rescues him. Suradas is very thankful to this boy and he tells the boy that, you know something, I really felt like my Krishna only came, because my Krishna is also a little boy like you. He asks him, what is your name? He says, my name is Gopal. And he says, oh, my Krishna's name is also Gopal only. And he says, okay, so what do you do? He asks the little boy. The little boy says that, I don't do anything. I daily take the cows out for grazing. He says, oh my God, you know, my Gopal also used to do this only. And then he is lovingly patting that boy. When his hand touches that boy's head, he feels that peacock feather. And then it's a moment of revelation for him. He realizes that actually his Gopal only came and rescued him. And even as he is thrilled with that, this little Krishna, naughty that he is always, just forces himself free from Suradas's grasp, grip, and runs away. And that is when he bursts into this song, saying, Bah chudaye jaatu ho, nibal janake moh. Meaning, you are freeing yourself from my grip and running away, thinking that I am weak. Hirudai se jab jao to sabal mein janu to. But I will not consider you strong unless you are able to free yourself from the grasp of my heart. I have captured you in my heart. Krishna, if you really have that strength, try to break free from there. And you know, this beautiful song comes saying, Hari main naina heena tum naina. I am blind, but you are my eye. In fact, story goes that Krishna actually appears before Suradas and grants him his vision, and he sees Krishna, he's lost in bliss. And then Suradas says that, having had your darshan full time completely, I keep seeing you only. What is the use of these eyes that can see anything else? So he prays to Krishna to take back the vision. So though he's been given eyesight, he prays that it be taken back, and till his bodily death, Suradas remains a blind person. But what a blessed blind person who has the continuous vision of the Lord.
Then absolutely. In fact, in Gita, Krishna says, you know, the point that Swami was making in that discussion, you know, Krishna says, Dhyayate Vishayan Pumsaha. He says you constantly contemplate on the things, and then you start getting attached to them, and when you don't get them, you get angry. And Swami says here, you know, the mind's major input comes from the eyes. And that's what Suradas says. Now I've seen only you. Now if you make me blind, I'll think only of you. But if you leave me with this eyesight, I don't know what I will see and what more I will start gathering into this mind. What a beautiful prayer to make, isn't it?
Absolutely. Going ahead, Hislop says, as Prem said, I think this is a totally different context. It's a new topic and the discussion is Vipassana meditation. Hislop says, it is very important to know what Swami said, that the ground from which desires arise is the mind making comparisons. Before I had the good fortune to meet Swami, my wife and I went to Burma every year for the practice of Vipassana meditation. It starts with Anapana. And Swami says, I know. The watchman at the point where the nose and lip meet. This is amazing. I was just looking at what Anapana is.
Mm-hmm.
So, it is a technique given by Buddha and practiced by the Buddha. It is the practice where you just watch your breath. Just watch your breath. I mean, you make no effort to moderate it or modulate it. If your breath is short, let it be short. If your breath is long, let it be long. You don't try to make any effort to moderate or modulate your breath. You just witness and observe it. No regulation, only observance. And you do this continuously for a period of time with no other thought. So that's called as anapana, and it's supposed to be the first process to quieten your mind and start going deeper. And even as Hislop says that it starts with anapana, Swami is saying, yeah, I know this is what it is. And as we shall see ahead, every little spiritual practice that we ever do in our life, Swami is there witnessing, aware, and if I may say, keeping a record. So we need not get disheartened that I have done so much, but I have not got anything. Not even one tiny wee bit that we have done for Swami will ever go in vain or waste. It will all come back to benefit us at the right time and place.
Absolutely. And you know how many times Swami has done this? I don't recall the exact details. One of our juniors who narrates, much before he joined Swami's college, he used to go to a Devi temple. And for some strange reason, sitting there, he would, you know, become very emotional thinking of the Divine Mother. And this was much before even he would qualify himself as a Swami's devotee. Mm. And later he comes to know Swami's college and then he joins. Then after a few years, Swami starts speaking to him. And we all know when Swami starts speaking to you, Swami will start with, what's your name? Where do you come from? What does your father do? And all that. And then finally one day Swami calls him for an interview. And Swami starts describing that act that he used to do of going and sitting in the temple and crying. Mm. And every thought which was running in his mind when he was sitting there and crying. Right? So every sadhana which is done is done for him, reaches him, and he's the witness within, right?
And so many times I think we have narrated this of Amritananda. Right. As a 7-year-old, he has done the Ganapati Homam for 42 days. And when he is 85-year-old, you know, something that happened 78 years ago, I think in 1870s, that's almost like 40 years even before Bhagwan made an advent.
Right.
Swami tells him that, I know you have done that, and the fruit for such a sadhana is to have the darshan of a golden Ganesha, and Swami grants him that. So like you said, when it is done in time, where it is done in space, it doesn't matter. Anything that is done, it reaches him. Like the saying goes, Akashat patitam toyam sagaram pratigachati, sarvadeva namaskaram keshavam pratigachati. Meaning, just like every drop of water that falls from the sky moves towards the ocean, every salutation that you offer to any name and form moves towards the same Lord.
Right. And here is Dr. Hislop talking about technique. You know, one thing is it was done in Burma maybe sometime back. But again, it's also a technique which Swami has not instructed people to do in that sense. You know, it is not part of the sadhanas of the Satisai organization.
Mm.
But that doesn't take away from the fact that it's a genuine attempt of a sadhaka. And here, even as he's narrating what he had done, Swami is saying, yeah, this is what happens next. And as we go through that conversation, you'll see where he mentions the name Anapana and Swami says, I know, the watchman at the point where the nose and lip meet. Then Hislop says, after the mind gets concentrated enough to sit there, the meditation teacher directed the concentration to the top of the head. And Swami says, then there was a sensation like ants crawling on the scalp. Right? Who else can tell you exactly what you felt? Hislop says, yes, Swami, wherever I placed my attention, there was intense burning. That fire is said to be the direct perception of the arising and immediate disintegration of the smallest particles of matter which comprise the body. The conscious perception of the fire burns up all impurities. Was the meditation master correct in what he said? So Swami is saying what exactly the sensation that he felt, but then Hislop is asking Swami, this is what he said is actually happening, is that right? Is what he's saying right?
In fact, whatever Swami says here, mm-hmm. in detail, Dr. John Hislop describes in his book, My Baba and I. So those who are interested can pick it up and read. In 2-3 pages, he writes his whole Vipassana experience.
Okay.
And I'm sure that he must have had his breath taken away when Swami is saying, that's why he says, yes, Swami, yeah, that's what it is. And this happened. And I think that is what actually gives him the kind of prodding to ask Swami that, so Swami, was that all right? Because Swami, you know everything. What is there to tell you? And Swami's answer is so beautiful. Swami says, it does not matter if the meditation master knew correctly or not. You did the work and you got the result. This is illustrated by a story. And I think this is so amazing, you know. When you're finding it difficult to understand something, Swami brings up a story and makes it so clear. Swami says, there was a guru and he had a woman disciple. The guru worshipped Krishna and he had a lingam which required daily puja. Each day at the time for puja, the disciple would bring the required milk. However, guru and disciple lived on opposite sides of the river. Heavy rains came and the river rose to a flood. The disciple had to wait for a boat and this made her late with the milk for the guru. He became angry that the puja could not be performed at the proper time and he told the disciple, "You're late because of lack of faith in the sacred name of Krishna. With faith in him and reciting his sacred name, you can walk across the surface of the river and will not have to wait for the boat." The next day, the disciple, accepting the word of her guru as the word of God himself, walked across the surface of the river and delivered the milk on time. After 2-3 days of this, the guru became curious and asked the disciple how she had arrived on time even though the river was in flood. The disciple replied that she did as instructed by the guru and walked across the river, constantly chanting the name of Krishna. The guru could not accept the story and secretly followed her as she departed. To his astonishment, the woman never hesitated but walked directly across the river. Instantly resolving to try it himself, he pulled up his dhoti above his knees and ventured to step into the water. The water failed to sustain him and he was instantly immersed. The story illustrates the vital role of faith. The woman enjoyed full faith and it never even occurred to her to even lift the hem of her sari for fear of the water, whereas faith was lacking in the guru. Everything becomes so clear. So Swami is saying, it doesn't matter whether what he said was right or not. You have done it sincerely and you have experienced it. Why are you seeking somebody else's,
validation.
Yes. Yeah. So nicely Swami says that. And this is a very popular story, Chinnakatha, that Swami has narrated. I think it is there in many other master stories also. Mm-hmm. But it shows that it is the faith that matters, not how many years of punditry you have or how much of knowledge you have.
Right. I think I might have narrated this episode before, which one of my seniors was once narrating. This happened in the mandir. He was sitting there when, we have in our college sometimes students joining in at the undergraduate level. You also have students who have come from the school, higher secondary school, who have studied 2 years there. Then you also have students who have come from the primary school, right from the first standard and so on. And each of their approach towards Swami will be very different. You would find that the students from the primary school are much more mature in understanding what Swami expects of students, the way they would speak to Swami, the way they would write letters to Swami. And you would have people who join in the graduate a little more fresh and naive in a sense. So there was this two seniors of mine, one of them from the school and the other who had just joined in the undergraduate few months back. So this fresh entrant was asking this other boy, in all sincerity and all devotion, he said, how can I make Swami to come and speak to me? Please tell me, brother, you've been here for so many years. Please tell me how to make Swami to speak to me. And to the point that this boy got a little irritated with this boy constantly asking him. And he said, brother, it's very simple. Don't speak. Just sit for 10 minutes and chant Gayatri Mantra for 108 times. Chant Sai Gayatri 408 times, Swami will come and speak to you. And he said it merely to keep this boy quiet.
To shut him up.
To keep him quiet and so that he can do the work which he was doing. And this boy took it very sincerely and he said, oh, is that so? Then I will do. And for the next 15 minutes, he closed his eyes and he chanted Sai Gayatri. And this boy was saying, he finished, he opened his eye, the interview room door opened, Swami walked out, came straight to him and Swami asked him, what is your name?
Mm-hmm.
Right? the boy who is meditating was not surprised because he expected that to happen. The boy who gave the advice was shaken.
Oh, wow.
He said, oh, my God. And I just told him casually and it really worked. Right? And that's exactly what Swami is saying here. That faith is what really makes Swami come, as that beautiful quotation that I often like to quote says, you know, prayer knocks the doors of heaven, but it's faith that opens it.
Mm.
Right? And this is clearly, and I think that is the demonstration that Swami allowed us to witness when Swami was physically around. Prayer works at all times, right? Faith works at all times. But you get a demonstration in front of your eyes when Swami is there, so that that faith can be established. You know, Swami might physically not be available now, but that the fact that faith works stands for eternity.
And that faith, as is evident from the story and the experience you narrated, doesn't depend on how many years you have spent with Swami. It doesn't depend on how many of his discourses you have read. Nothing. Faith is faith. And I think it gets demonstrated when you put it into practice. So many times when we get difficult situations in our life, we wonder, Swami, why are we going through this? Swami, when will this end? Why are you not stopping this? I think these are the times when we get to practice our faith. It's like learning to ride a bicycle. How much ever you may learn the theory, you know, when it's falling to the left, turn the handle to the right a bit. Try to shift the weight to the other side. If it's falling that side, try to shift the weight to this side. You know, trying to teach my daughter how to ride the bicycle. I have given her so many lectures, but I think they are of no use. She has had 2-3 falls and she's still learning. And I think finally, you just learn it intuitively. It's not something that you do with your head. Because if it's something that you do with the head, how is it that we are able to ride a two-wheeler and, you know, carry out a conversation, right, look at the sights around? It just happens so unconsciously. So there's no logic involved over there. So it's something that you learn with practice, and that's how even faith comes, I think. That's why we should welcome these difficult situations. They are wonderful opportunities for us to experiment and strengthen our faith. And once we strengthen it, you see, like, it's like once we learn how to balance and ride the two-wheeler, never again will you have a fear of falling. I mean, it doesn't matter however bumpy the road, however the climate is, nothing matters. I'll be able to ride on. In the same way, I think, if we look at all these difficult trials and tribulations as times when we can strengthen our faith and our balance, I think that would be the best way to go ahead and best thing to learn. So faith is the practice of faith, not the proclamation of it.
Right, and that's a beautiful conversation, as we said. You know, 2-3 things that come out is, one is, however lonely you might be while doing sadhana, you are not all alone, because Swami is there witnessing it, and Swami is there as a witness to the experience itself. And the second point that Swami made is, it doesn't matter, you know, whether the person who's telling you believes in what he says or genuine. And many times as speakers, I often say this to the audience, you know, only to an extent look at me to see whether I'm following what I'm saying. Because what I'm saying is what Swami has said, right? And whether the speaker is following what is being said or not, it doesn't really matter. If you really have faith in Swami's words, it will work for you, right? Whether I'm following it or not is my sadhana. That's a different thing. Thought, word, and deed, unity is what we have to be working on. You know, you could take a book which is dirty and ragged, and if it speaks of the value of cleanliness, can the value of cleanliness be any way lesser because it is being written on a dirty book? Right? That's what it is. And I think whenever we listen to any discourse or any lecture, if the word is the word of Swami, it doesn't matter who is saying it or who is speaking about it. If we take it to heart and if we nurture it there, we will benefit from that.
At this point, dear listeners, there's again another change in topic. It's a very beautiful one, and Swami discourses on it quite in some detail. It's on dealing with conflict. We will deal with that after this second little break. So don't go away anywhere. We'll be back very soon.
దేవాది దేవా శ్రీ సాయి దేవా, దేవాది దేవా శ్రీ సాయి దేవా, భావాల నివసించవా స్వభావాల ప్రభవించవా. సేవించు ప్రేమించు సుగుణంబు మాకు, సేవించు ప్రేమించు సుగుణంబు మాకు, దీవించి అందించవా దీవించి అందించవా, పరిపాలించి నడిపించవా పరిపాలించి నడిపించవా. మదిలోన తలచేటి కొలిచేటి వారు, మధుర మధుర పదములతో పాడేటి వారు, మదిలోన తలచేటి కొలిచేటి వారు, మధుర మధుర పదములతో పాడేటి వారు, హృదయమునందు మిమ్ము నింపేటి వారు, హృదయమునందు మిమ్ము నింపేటి వారు, వందనీయులే సదా నీ దాసులైన వారు, వందనీయులే సదా నీ దాసులైన వారు. దేవాది దేవా శ్రీ సాయి దేవా, దేవాది దేవా శ్రీ సాయి దేవా, భావాల నివసించవా స్వభావాల ప్రభవించవా. సేవించు ప్రేమించు సుగుణంబు మాకు, సేవించు ప్రేమించు సుగుణంబు మాకు, దీవించి అందించవా దీవించి అందించవా, పరిపాలించి నడిపించవా పరిపాలించి నడిపించవా. అమరులైన అందలేని ఆనందానుభూతి, అమరునులేని భక్తుల దెందములోని ఖ్యాతి, అమరులైన అందలేని ఆనందానుభూతి, అమరునులేని భక్తుల దెందములోని ఖ్యాతి, విమలంబు కలిగి మిమ్ము సంతస పరిచేరీతి, విమలంబు కలిగి మిమ్ము సంతస పరిచేరీతి, సమయంబు చూసి మాకు ఇత్తువయ్య ధర్మ నిరతి, సమయంబు చూసి మాకు ఇత్తువయ్య ధర్మ నిరతి. దేవాది దేవా శ్రీ సాయి దేవా, దేవాది దేవా శ్రీ సాయి దేవా, భావాల నివసించవా స్వభావాల ప్రభవించవా. సేవించు ప్రేమించు సుగుణంబు మాకు, సేవించు ప్రేమించు సుగుణంబు మాకు, దీవించి అందించవా దీవించి అందించవా, పరిపాలించి నడిపించవా పరిపాలించి నడిపించవా.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and we'll continue with the conversation. As we just said, there is a change in theme again, but the discussion is something that is very relevant for us, be it at home, at work, or even within the organization. So the question that Hislop asks is this: Swami, conflict between people appears to be inevitable. What to do? And Swami's response to that is, conflicts do come about, but they should be limited to that point, to the fact of conflict, and should not be allowed to spread into additional words and feelings. If the conflict is allowed to expand, anger will deepen, bitter feelings will arise, and strong hatred will develop. On the other hand, love also starts as a point, and if allowed to do so, will expand until it fills one's entire life. This is the spiritual truth. If there is conflict and disharmony between two people, and if they will leave it at that and not allow it to move further, then before long, both parties will soften and harmony can again come into the relationship. At the worst, the conflict will remain dormant and will not grow into involving other people. The practice of limiting disharmony and allowing love to freely expand will bring an organization to a harmonious unity. The harmony will then attract public admiration and make possible great accomplishments in the large, wealthy country of America. So that is the response that Swami gives us, saying such a practical thing. And if we really go into the root of conflicts that destabilize organizations or homes or teams, whatever it is only this, that our inability to contain a conflict to only that scenario and to only that argument, right?
It's like a fire, you know, that if you don't contain within the region that is there, it'll just grow big and burn the whole thing.
Right, everything becomes a conflict then.
Yes, everything becomes a conflagration and it burns down the whole, whether you say it's a team, a country or... And you know, when Swami is saying it makes possible to have great accomplishments in the large wealthy country of America, I was just looking at the coincidence of we reading this today, even as the polls are being tallied right. In the United States, there is so much of divisiveness, there's so much of separation, there's so much of polarization, hatred, all this happening. And you really feel, yes, that is what has happened. What has possibly happened over the last few years is the direct opposite of what Swami is saying. Swami is saying that anything that brings conflict and discontent, keep it contained only that much and let it go. And anything that is, Swami is saying, even love and good things also work that way. You emphasize on that and build on that, that will also grow. It's not just fire that burns everything. Even water will wet everything if it's allowed to flow. But the opposite has happened. You know, good things and lovely things, noble things are not spoken about so much possibly, and a lot of emphasis is being put on the hatred and separation and greed, and it has just kept growing. In fact, speaking of America, it reminds me of a Cherokee story. The Cherokees are the Native Indians, Native Americans. They used to be called the Red Indians, or you know, in, usually right now they are in the North Carolina area, possibly.
Okay.
So there's a very wise and beautiful Cherokee story of a Cherokee storyteller telling his grandson that inside each one of us, there are two wolves that are constantly fighting each other. One wolf stands for all the negative traits, you know, like ego, jealousy, hatred, anger, pride, envy, all these. While the other wolf, the white wolf, stands for all the good, which is truth, righteousness, love, peace, non-violence, all these. And these wolves keep battling day in and day out within us throughout. And when he says this, the grandson asks the grandfather, which of the two wolves win finally? That is what I want to know. And the grandfather smiles and says, whichever wolf you choose to feed. Whichever wolf you feed is the one that will be healthier and stronger and that will win. But that is what it is. That is what Swami is saying here. That if we feeding is nothing but what we focus on. At a physical level, feeding is what we eat. At a mental level, it's what we focus on. The more we focus on the conflicts, the more we focus on the differences and the hatred, that is going to be the predominant attitude, that is going to be the predominant environment that we create. But instead, as Swami says, if we focus on the love, the good things, even a tiny little spark of goodness can be nurtured carefully into a conflagration. In fact, that is what we see during the Dasara Yagnam as well. A small spark, a small tiny fire is generated in the traditional manner, and that is stoked and carefully nurtured. It becomes a Yagnam fire which is capable of burning anything in its wake.
Right, and the thing is, you cannot have a situation or a scenario where there are no conflicts at all. Right. Mm. What Swami is saying is very important in that sense. And Swami would quote one Sanskrit shloka. He says, I think it's Munde
Matir Bhinna.
Swami would say, every head will have a different opinion, right? And there are two heads, there will be two opinions. And you can imagine, there will always be conflict in that sense. And that is why this is so important. You cannot work towards, or you cannot aspire for, a conflictless situation. You should have a way by which conflicts have to be
resolved.
And that is, there is a situation, there is an argument, there are pros and cons being discussed. Then limit it only to that situation. Right? This is so very true for, as I was saying, within families, within friends, within teams working in the office, or so much important for the organization. Because we've seen this so many times, even in the scope of our work or organization, because the goal is the same, right? You want to please Swami. That is the goal. And there are 100 ways of doing that. Somebody says that this is how we should work and please Swami. Somebody else says that no, this is not how you should work. This is the way we have to do it to please Swami. So the goal is the same. So there will always be that conflict. Contain it to that. Sometimes you have to let conflict be. As I always keep quoting this piece written by Abraham Lincoln. It is called The Meditation on the Will. It's a very beautiful thing. It was apparently a piece of note that he wrote and left in his drawer, which his assistant saw many years later and published it. Right? We all know that one of the greatest conflicts that he was stuck up in between is abolishment of slave trade.
So slavery, yes.
Right? Mm. Many of the states actually wanted it to be there. And there were southern states which didn't want it. And that was the conflict. They thought that the United States is going to break up based on this conflict. And at one point, it seems Abraham Lincoln starts wondering. Says, Swami, not Swami, says, God, it is very clear to me that this is the right thing. That you've created all men equal and one should not rule over the other. This seems like this is the right thing. No, my conscience says this is the right. But still there are some people who clearly feel that to have slavery is the right thing, right? If you really were by my side, by now this conflict will be over, right? If you had willed that one side should win, then the one side should have won. The very fact that you have not willed one side should win means you have willed the conflict, right? So he says that there must be something good that is supposed to come out of this conflict, and that's why you will the conflict.
Hmm.
At this point in time, I'm not able to see what is that you willed. But maybe this is meant to be, right? And that's the meditation on the divine will that he writes. And it's so true, right? If Swami wanted that, only one side should remain, only one side would have remained. The very fact that there is a conflict means something is supposed to come out of that churning.
Of course, going back to the discussion we had some time ago, for such a kind of surrender, you need faith. You need absolute faith, because otherwise, it will not be possible to think the way Abraham Lincoln thought. Going ahead, Swami continues, he's still speaking about the same theme. Swami says, each member of the organization would do well to do each and every action for Sai. If every action is done for Sai, then Sai will be added to every action and will bring success to that action. If action is with Sai, then the actor is with Sai. The actor will then not be different from Sai. He will be Sai. He who becomes like Brahma is Brahma. I think Swami quotes Brahma with Brahma Iva Bhavati. Sai divided into Jiva, or the individual soul, and becomes Jiva. Sai divided into infinity becomes infinity. Jiva divided into Sai becomes infinity. And then Swami says, in spiritual life, the first point of approach for any problem is to observe the situation with respect to oneself and first improve that situation. If after that the other person continues to offend, he may be warned once, twice or three times. If there is still no improvement, the person may be removed from the organization office. Then the person should be forgiven. How beautiful, you know, in the end you have to forgive. And Swami says, first of all, there's a problem. Look at what is the mistake in you and correct it. I think these are very clear tenets that shows that the Satsasai organization is a spiritual organization. If we are not following this route that Swami gives, you know, if at all some offense happens, somebody is offending you, if we jump first at saying how mistakeful the other person is and what he has done wrong, I think we are forgetting the basic tenet. Swami is saying, use every of those opportunities to correct and improve yourself. If after that a problem persists, warn once, twice or thrice. If there's still no improvement, remove the person, but after that immediately ensure that it's followed up with forgiveness.
Right, it's so very beautiful the way Swami puts it. And the first point is, I think, where all of us fail. You know, forget about the second, third, and going up till forgiveness is a long way away. Because even in any situation, we always think in what way the other person is wrong, right? And given that we are all human, it's very easy to find faults in the person opposite. And Swami says that even a wrong person can come and point out a mistake in you. What is wrong in that, right? Even a imperfect mirror can show you if something is wrong in your appearance. Not always an imperfect mirror shows you something that is not there, right? So first point Swami says is, even if the person who's telling you is wrong, is not the, you know, is the person who's the source of the conflict, so to say, if there is in any way you can correct anything in yourself, let that be the first step. And Swami says that yes, there will be difficult people. It is not like always you are wrong. There will be cases where the other person is also wrong. And then Swami gives the sequence of events that you can do. But Swami says eventually even that person has to be forgiven. After saying that, remove the person from the organization, Swami says forgive. It is not like, I think this is again in jurisprudence they say. There are some countries which hold on to this principle very strongly. That if you have done a crime, if you've served a sentence, then you're no more a criminal. You've done a mistake, you've paid for it. You're no more a criminal.
Your slate is clean.
Right, your slate is clean. But there are some societies which say that if you've done a crime, you're a criminal for life. Right? So Swami is saying that that should not be the attitude.
There's no redemption.
Right. You've done a mistake, you've paid for it, then you have to forgive that person. Right. Very, very beautifully and practically explained.
You know, the famous Chanakya, who is supposed to have given the Niti Shastra, the Artha Shastra, the way a kingdom should conduct itself, the way the economy should go, one of the greatest thinkers of all times from India. And, you know, having gone through a little bit of the Artha Shastra, I just feel that if we can adopt the kind of economy that he has envisaged, the world will be a much more harmonious place with far lesser inequalities than we see today. Anyway, he quotes four upayas, upayas meaning techniques or ideas, in order to resolve conflicts. He says the first method is sama. Sama meaning compromise. You just talk it out and yes, you let go of a little bit, the other person lets go of a little bit, the conflict is resolved. When sama doesn't work, he says use dana. Gift, be large-hearted, be generous, just gift the other person. And you know, hope that the conflict gets resolved. When sama, dana don't work, you go to bheda. Bheda meaning bringing up logical arguments and trying to explain and make the other person understand that this is wrong, you're not supposed to do it.
Sometimes it is even threatening actually.
Bheda, yes.
Bheda. Give a picture of what will happen if you go down this road.
Yes, yes. And finally, when all of them fail, he says use danda, which is punishment, which I think Swami was saying, remove them from the organization. But even Chanakya, the great thinker and an awesome, awesome guy, you know, my admiration for him is very high. Such a person also stops at Samadana, Beda and danda. Swami goes ahead and saying, after Samadana, Beda, danda, whatever you do, then it has to be followed up with Kshama. So beautiful it is. I think it is Swami who has given us the fifth upaya or fifth technique and idea. Irrespective of what you do, it has to end with Kshama. And I think because this Kshama helps in bringing harmony to the other person as well as yourself, because any of the thing, you know, whether it's compromise, whether it is gifting, whether it is logic, or whether we use punishment, any of the things that we use, definitely it's not going to be 100% equal. One side is going to lose more than the other side. And if there's no Kshama that follows these, definitely there's going to be seeds for a future revenge or vengeance being planted. In fact, when we study our world history, that is what it is. World War I, whoever was wrong, whoever was right, that's fine. After the war, after the punishments were done, because there was no forgiveness, I think it gave birth to the monster that the world knows as Adolf Hitler today. And yes, and you know, when people wonder why is it that he was so supported, when there is that feeling of revenge, because there was no Kshama, because there was no forgiveness, you can't say that I just put a small fire, I didn't expect it to be a conflagration. You don't know how it will grow. That's why Swami says, all said and done, finally extinguish all the ill will through Kshama. Be forgiving and forgive and forget.
Right, and the two points that occur to me when you're saying about Samabeda, Samadana Beda Danda is, if you recall, we had done a satsang long ago about Krishna being for peace and not for war.
He's not a warmonger.
Right, in that discourse, Swami says that actually Krishna follows all of this. Hmm. Right, first Sama, where you know there is peaceful negotiations that are going. Then he actually says that, you know, give me 5 villages, that is good enough. That you're being more charitable than the other person in trying to resolve the issue. And then he strikes fear. He said, do you know what Arjuna is capable of? Don't you know the vow that Bhima has taken? Even when that doesn't work out, that is when he says, okay, now there's nothing left to do other than go for war. Right? Because this is a righteous thing to do, and this is, everything has been followed. Right? So that is why this is a very, very beautiful technique given by Chanakya, as you said. And talking about the final thing, that forgiveness, there's a beautiful quote by Nelson Mandela. It's very, very famous. I'm sure most of the listeners also will be aware. He says, as I walked out the door towards the gate that would lead me to my freedom, I knew that if I didn't leave my bitterness and hatred behind, I'd still be in prison.
Hmm.
So he says, I am walking out of here and I am...
When he's walking out of the prison, actually.
Right, after 27 years, right? 23 or 27 years being in prison. He's saying that if I walk out of here, if I don't forgive the people who put me behind bars, I am still in prison.
Hmm.
He says, so forgiveness is a quality that frees you more than it is a service to the person who is being forgiven. So in that sense, Swami is saying that that's the whole idea, you know, in a spiritual organization, you are trying to labor towards freedom. And if you are going to be holding grudges against people, then what's the whole point, right?
That's exactly what is amplified when Swami says after that, this act of forgiving will bring about a change in the person and also in the one who forgives.
Beautiful.
Suppose, for example, someone does something which brings severe pain into Swami's heart. What is the medicine which will cure the pain? That medicine is forgiveness. Forgiving is the medicine which will totally remove the pain from Swami's heart. I mean, anyone who feels that he or she loves Swami after reading this will have no more logic or arguments against forgiveness. It doesn't matter whether forgiveness is showing weakness or whether forgiveness actually works or not. Swami says that if at all there's a hurt in Swami's heart, the only way you can cure that hurt is by forgiving. I think for us who don't want to cause any hurt in Swami's heart, forgiving should become a way of life.
Really, I mean, there's nothing more to be said than that. So very clearly and beautifully Swami explains that. In fact, I think there are plenty of discourses where Swami has spoken only about Kshama. Right, only the value of forbearance. Swami would say that statement that you would make, Kshama Dharma, Kshama Prema, Kshama is, he says everything, all qualities put together is Kshama. It is not just forgiveness. It is forgiveness, forbearance, patience, everything put together. It's one of the most profound qualities Swami speaks of. Talking about this thing of restricting conflict or restricting things to the issues alone, just a couple of days back I was listening to a talk by one of our brothers, Brother Harish, We all know that he was one of the boys who had the opportunity to serve Swami physically. You know, the boys who used to walk behind Swami during darshan. So he was narrating this episode, a very small episode, but the way Swami reacts and Swami responds, you know. Swami was those days coming in a wheelchair, which used to come out of the car, right? So Swami had come for darshan or something, or Swami was in some other gathering. Swami's chair was coming out, and we all know that there used to be two boys who would come, would stand next to the chair when it is coming out. So depending on whom Swami would indicate to, they would you know, take Swami's chair out and come for darshan. So one of the boys came and sat on one side, and the other boy stood on the other side. So Harish was standing on the right side of Swami, and this boy came and sat here. Seeing the boy who was kneeling down, Swami looked at him and gave a very, very angry look, and Swami said, "Move out of there." So this boy got really scared. He didn't know what he had done, that Swami was so upset with him. And Swami was furious. You could see it on Swami's face, and everybody could see that Swami was so upset. So this boy immediately got up and went behind. And generally what we do is we don't show our face to Swami, you know, when he is upset. So he also kept away for the rest of the session. Then Swami went inside the interview room, or Swami retired, I think. So he thought that, let me go and, you know, submit to Swami and seek forgiveness. So he went to Swami. Swami looked at him and Swami said, "What happened? Why have you come?" So he said, "Swami, I wanted to seek forgiveness. I'm really sorry, Swami." Swami gave a blank look, and Swami said, "Sorry for what?" He said, "Swami, just some time back, Swami was very upset with me. And Swami shouted at me." "Shouted? Me?" Swami said. And that the way Swami said it was so genuine. Right? Swami said, "I shouted at you. I was upset with you. Why? What happened?" He said, "Swami, just now," and he explained the whole situation. And Swami said, "Ledu bangaru, aim ledu," nothing like that. So Harish was saying that, you know, Swami is coming out for darshan, and probably this boy just blocked some genuine devotee from having darshan, you know, by sitting there. And that devotee must have given a painful anguish from his heart, and that must have reached Swami, and Swami responded to that by saying, "How dare you come in between me and my devotees?" But that's it. It ended there. That anger just stopped there. It was not an anger towards that person, or, you know, "How dare you come and do this?" I think what Swami says here is that, I think that ability was so phenomenal, and we've witnessed it so many times. The ability to just restrict that emotion to that moment and not carry it forward.
Beautiful. And if we are not able to do that, the final solution is, as Swami says, kshama.
Right.
Just like I think we had discussed it sometime back, that anger is an asset that damages the vessel in which it is stored more than the vessel in which it is poured. Swami is saying here that forgiveness is a balm that will heal the heart which gives it more than the heart that receives it. Possibly we'll conclude today's satsang with one final idea that Swami says. One more discussion, one little thing. Swami says, people who have developed a big intellect use it to entertain many ideas. And in this soil, doubts grow. The humble, ordinary person knows much truth directly and does not cultivate as many doubts. Best of all is to have faith like a mountain of ice or a mountain of fire, which does not provide soil for even a single doubt to germinate and grow. Where energy has been stored as intellect, that energy must be channeled into constructive activity. So while, you know, we speak of knowledge being absolutely essential for getting the ultimate liberation, Swami also says that the intellect also becomes a hindrance in faith. And because of that, it can also become a hindrance. And that's why I think possibly all the while there's a lot of emphasis on bhakti, the path of devotion, as the easiest and most beautiful path to reach, Swami. There are other ways to reach, but this is the easiest, because the same knowledge that you're trying to acquire so that you get moksha is like a double-edged sword. It can also lead to doubts being sprouted in your mind.
Right, and it's like we always think of the potential of intellect, the potential of what wealth can provide, you know, storing all our abilities and things in that potential so that you will need it. I mean, you'll have it when you need it. Here Swami is speaking of the potential of faith. Can you store everything in that form of faith, and nothing more is required at the time when you need it? Right?
I think on that note, we will conclude today's satsang, dear listeners. And as I said right in the beginning, it's not that this is the last you'll hear of us today. We will be back to fill your ears once again in the evening. That's from 7:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. Indian Standard Time. On Asia Stream as well as on the YouTube channel. And as I said, I would recommend that you go to the YouTube channel. It was a nice and happy period of the year for us now, because, you know, it is November and it is the month of our dear Swami's birthday. And whenever we have a birthday in the family, we spend a lot of time and energy thinking as to what is the best gift possibly that we can give. So every year we come up with this thought as well, that when Swami's birthday is coming, what is a gift that he will appreciate, what is it that we can give. And each time we discuss it, we get different insights and ideas, and that is what possibly we will be attempting today evening as well. So do tune in and catch us live at that time. And as always, you can leave your comments there, or you can write your comments to us at listener@radiosai.org. On that note, we offer this humbly at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan, and we leave you with a song on the other side of which you can tune into the program Veda Jignyasa from Brother Ganesh. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
Your feet are the